Well, I believe in young Earth, so obviously creation and basically sola scriptura. So I'm curious. Yeah, you can laugh at me. I'm cool with that. But please, you know, give me something. I'm curious where you want to go at it.
I'm not in the mood for a Bible conversation, but...
We can keep it to science then.
Yeah, like, sure. If you were going to present the best evidence that the universe is somehow hundreds of thousands of times younger than science reveals to us that it is, what would you use as your evidence?
Less evidence for, more evidence of... Science has a huge habit of extrapolating beyond what I think is reasonable. So, you know, science, in the scientific method, it uses observation. So we can't look into the past, really.
Yes, you can.
There's arguments against it.
Light has to travel to you.
Yes. Okay. Well, there's a counter argument to that. So, like, with young Earth, it's a mature creation. There's no reason why God can't create the universe in a mature fashion.
What's the evidence of that?
Oh, there isn't.
Okay, so you don't have any evidence. So there's no reason to think it's true. Pretend the Bible doesn't exist. How old would somebody think the universe is?
Oh, billions of years. Millions. Or, I think the current, it's like 7 billion is the current consensus?
No, 7 billion years old. Okay. So then what justification do you have for your claim that it's hundreds of thousands of times younger than it is to an objective observer other than book say thing?
Yeah, I think science and philosophy are intrinsically linked, and to discuss either one without the other is an incomplete picture. So I'm a little bit like, I think there is a philosophy attached to evolution. As well as the Big Bang.
Whatever philosophical underpinnings behind evolution and the Big Bang are going to be in no way different than the philosophical underpinnings behind whatever it is we use to understand whether or not the Earth goes around the sun or the other way around. They're just the scientific philosophical underpinnings are identical in both cases. The only you only reject one because you think it interferes with your faith, and so I don't think that
that's
an honest reason to do anything.
I think the extrapolation of the observation that you're making, we can observe currently that the Earth rotates around the sun.
No, we can't.
But we can't observe.
You cannot watch that happen.
Then what do you think the scientific observation is that led to our belief that the Earth rotates around the sun?
More accurate and parsimonious models, because every single
it's not observation from us looking at stars and a star map around us and knowing that we are moving within a field of stars.
So
that's observation. We're looking at
for thousands of years, for very, very good reasons, everybody assumed that the sun went around the Earth. As the Bible clearly says.
That's not true. That's not true. That was
those things are both true.
In the Middle Ages.
No,
a popularized theory in the Middle Ages that was
who
not
were the great helios? Who were the great heliocentrists of antiquity?
It was put forward as a theory.
Yeah, but nobody really believed it except Aristarchus of Samos, but he couldn't really get anybody to buy into it. And I think he actually didn't believe it either. He just tried. He made some successful attempts at demonstrating it, but this is just like, this is not controversial that people thought that the sun orbited a stationary Earth for all of human history until, pretty recently. It wasn't, the world was not popularized mostly by heliocentrists, and then it changed in the Middle Ages. That's not the case at all.
Okay, so I'm not sure where to go with that. I just don't agree as far as the historical perspective there.
We Well, you're just going to have to read some books or something. I don't know. I can recommend you some. The reason we got on this was because you said, well, we prove the Earth is going around the sun through observation. Your observations only make it look like the moon and the sun go. Well, the moon does go around the Earth, but your observations only really make sense in a geocentric frame of reference. And even though our models make it pretty clear that it's the other way around, this is more sophisticated science, but with our most advanced physics, like general relativity, general relativity really proves that you cannot demonstrably prove that the sun doesn't go around the Earth, because you can model it with the science. It works perfectly well. It's just that the formulation of it becomes so incredibly complicated and bonkers that using the principle of parsimony, we just simply are basically forced to logically and probabilistically conclude that that model is almost certainly false and Earth going around the sun is almost certainly true.
So we make no observations of the other planets rotating around the sun and not us with telescopes and all of our advanced hardware. We don't observe that at all.
We observe them moving. We observe them moving, but you can't watch. Look, if I look at the clock on the wall, I can see the minute hand go around the center. You can't watch the planet Jupiter go around the sun from our vantage point. You can't do that. You'd have to be billions upon billions of miles away, I guess, looking down at the solar system. And then in a way but all we do is we track their motion and then we plug it into mathematical models. And the models that have the planets going around the sun are more accurate and simpler. And so they're taken to almost certainly be the true ones. Just for those reasons, though.
Universal.
You're cutting in and out again really badly.
I apologize. I'm trying to move it to a better spot.
Yeah.
Can you hear me now?
Yep. Sounds good.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. So that's observation. The first step there is observation of the planetary bodies. And then we use a mathematical model, which is extrapolation on the observation, correct?
Yeah.
Okay. So I just disagree with the extrapolations on certain scientific beliefs that are held today.
So do flat earthers.
And they can be wrong.
So can young earth creationists. Like,
disagreement with a consensus is not evidence that that disagreement, that belief is wrong in and of itself.
But if the consensus is collected if we get to the consensus via the sciences, which are our best, that's the best we can do at understanding the natural world, then there's a rigorous, well-attested process that goes into what that consensus is. And so if you're going to go against the consensus, then probabilistically, you're almost certainly wrong. This can also be demonstrated historically. And there have been cavaliers that ended up being right about things that the consensus was wrong about. But pretty much in all those cases, the consensus didn't actually have very good evidence for their claim. So there just was a lack of total evidence. And so they just had to go with what seemed natural to them.
The evidence or the observation stayed the same, and the extrapolation of the information gained from that observation, which people use as evidence, was incorrect.
That's generally the case, but in quite a lot of the paradigm shifting sciences, nobody had the observations in the first place. Like, we didn't, I don't know, what's a good paradigm shifter? Like a general and special relativity. We didn't have the data or the math for general and special relativity before Einstein. So it wasn't like your case of, well, their extrapolations were simply wrong the whole time. No, a lot of those extrapolations come out for the first time with the new data, and then Einstein's theories were proven correct via experiments and observations later on. So
I don't see how this disproves my statement, though, because the objection is
it doesn't really disprove it. It just doesn't really work in the way you're saying it works most of the time historically. We're pretty far off the topic here, though. So all I'm trying to tell you is,
all right, let's go to Big Bang then. I'd love to talk about that because I want to hear. Sure. I was listening to other discussion, and I think my understanding of the Big Bang is actually different from the way that you were talking about it. So what is your belief as far as the Big Bang?
We live in an expanding universe that began expanding from an initial state of incredibly high temperature and density. We don't know what comes before that. We don't know what made it start doing that. We don't know what it'll be doing a trillion years from now. Not yet, at least.
I have no objection to that, actually. I don't think that... Okay. Weirdly enough, yeah, but I don't have any objection to that.
Well, you have to be a young Earth creationist, or you have to appeal to miracles.
Which, if you are a young Earth creationist, you say the whole universe was created via miracle, so...
Sure, that's also an argument for last Thursdayism.
Define that, please.
The whole universe was created last Thursday, and it just looks the way it looks, and we all have the memories we have because we were implanted with those memories. It works exactly the same as your argument for a creation in a garden 6,000 years ago with a universe that somehow is already billions of light years across and a man who somehow already knows how to speak. He never had to learn how to speak or anything. So he ostensibly has what could be compared to at least memories of things. So it's exactly the same.
Yeah. I mean, logically, that is consistent.
Right. So what do we do to so if we have three competing ideas, the universe was created last Thursday, was created 6,000 years ago, or was created billions of years ago. Since logically they're all on equal footing, we got to go somewhere else to determine which one is most likely to be true. Now, as you admitted, all the objective sciences endorse only one position, and I don't think we have anything other than book say thing for position number... I'm just going to call yours position number two for whatever reason.
I mean, it doesn't matter which position it's in. Okay, but what about all of the non-consensus opinions within science that account for things that are supposedly in agreement with the Bible? Let's say consistently in archaeology, people have claimed biblical civilizations don't exist. I believe one was the Assyrians. And then I don't want to say it wrong, but I want to say late 1800s, they found the Assyrian capital. And it immediately went from, well, this is something that we use to disprove the Bible to something that we use to prove it.
I've never heard that anybody has ever thought that Assyria didn't exist. I know a guy, Dr. Josh Bowen. He's literally an Assyriologist. Now, he's not 300 years old, so he didn't become one in the 1800s. I've never heard of anyone thinking Assyria didn't exist. Okay. There were people that thought this isn't biblical, but like there were people that thought Troy didn't exist and then we found it. But buddy, like, I'm an atheist. Okay. I don't know if you knew that, but I'm an atheist. I think Jesus existed. If somehow one of those, fraudulent items associated with him somehow got proven to be linked to Jesus, that would only confirm what I already believed. I still wouldn't believe in God. So, like, the existence of Jericho, the existence of, I don't know, whatever, Babylon's in the Bible, the existence of Bethlehem and Nazareth, these towns, sure, I can believe that things in the Bible really happened. I don't think the miracles happened. The existence of Assyria doesn't prove that the miracles are real any more than the existence of Manhattan proves that a web-slinging friendly neighborhood spider is real.
Okay. It was a little bit more, not as direct of a connection there. I was saying arguments used against something because of lack of evidence, can be used to support it in the future when new evidence is presented. That's the argument I was trying to make.
I mean, okay. I don't know what subject we're on right now, but I don't know.
Yeah, if you
think somehow we will have evidence that the universe, that we can actually objectively measure the universe to be only 6,000 years old when all of our other measurements are so out of line with that, it's just ridiculous. Then you'd have to present what they are. I've heard some, like the anisotropic synchronization convention, which is just, it's complete garbage. It fundamentally cannot possibly work with Maxwell's equations. So you'd have to literally rewrite all of our electromagnetic sciences. And there are just so many reasons to think that anisotropy is not true, right? Like this, that's Jason Lyle. He's a young earth creationist. That's his idea. I mean, all the attempts, they never, ever, ever work like at all. Anyways,
go on. All right. Well, let me use an example of something that I'm more familiar with. In the Victorian era, they believed that mercury had healing qualities. Do we agree on that?
People thought that the first emperor of China believed
exactly.
that,
yeah.
and that's
it's,
how he
it was
died.
A belief for a long, long time. The reason why I say the Victorian era is that they had a very similar mentality that we do today, where they thought they had all the answers. Do you object to that?
I don't really know what to say with respect to that. If you're talking about people in general or scientists in the Victorian era?
Mostly the scientists. So the scientists in the Victorian era, very common that they were like, I know this for sure. And then now we've either proven them wrong or we don't agree with them on a mass scale anymore. So I'm going, okay, what stops the current consensus from being just another repeat of that, where we get together in our high and mighty thoughts of ourselves and go, well, we all know what's right, right? And everybody agrees, even though it's something that's so wildly wrong. Just because it looks
right. What I would say is you would agree that doing science is pretty difficult, right?
Oh, yeah. The scientific method is not easy to follow.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like discovering, for example, that atoms exist is technologically very difficult, right?
Yes, I will agree with that. Yeah.
And
not
so,
an easy problem.
In the past, we just didn't know as much as we do today. So what's kind of weird about that is when people are ignorant, they tend to assume that there's less to discover. And so that's just kind of a phenomenon that's just kind of generally true a lot of the time. And so, yeah, if what you're saying about the Victorian era, if that's true that they assumed that, then yeah. But that might actually be a consequence of they didn't know what they don't know. Like, we know what we don't know today about quite a lot of scientific ideas. So we know what to keep looking for, and maybe they just couldn't even predict what they'll discover in the future and what they don't know. But anyways, the other thing is you can only make like groundbreaking, paradigm shifting discoveries when you're mostly ignorant about things. Like when Van Leeuwenhoek discovered that there were microorganisms. That was a very dramatic, radical thing because we just didn't know anything about that. You know, the discovery of DNA is less radical, I would argue, than the discovery of microorganisms, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the thing about the reason why I don't think that somehow tomorrow or 100 years from now or 1,000 years from now, we're going to discover that, yeah, all those, like, all that science we had about evolution, it was consistent, but it turned out to be wrong, or the Big Bang. The reason I don't think that's going to happen is, this is a little bit weird, but it's because there are huge numbers of scientific discoveries that happen today, but they're all kind of like, what we're doing is we're polishing the knowledge we have. We started off with something extremely rough, and the big paradigm shifting discoveries shape the modern theories, and now we're kind of polishing them. Famously, like in physics, we've been stuck for a really long time on certain ideas, but the facts of like what we know in physics and have uncovered are really incredible. We know all of the physics of ordinary day-to-day life. And like compositionally, like what things are made of. We have our standard model. It's probably complete. Maybe there's a graviton. Maybe there isn't. But there's, I don't think that there's actually very good reason to think that there's a huge amount to add to it. So the fact that science has remained consistent and there haven't been monumental paradigm shifts that have happened for a while now, despite our technological abilities, to me is extraordinarily good evidence that what we have now is a firm established baseline. Like, you don't think we're going to somehow discover the Earth is actually flat in the future. Your reasons for that are my reasons for thinking that we're going to think the age of the universe is still the same 1,000 years from now.
Okay. I mean, I can't object to anything that you just said, really. Because at the end of the day, it boils down to we just disagree on conclusion of the facts. I think that there's more to discover that's going to change people's consensus on things. And I base that off of my pre-existing belief in what I believe to be a supernatural book. Mostly, it's a psychological thing. Mostly, it's a societal thing, to be completely honest. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. So.
You sound exactly like Brett Weinstein, I just noticed. It's funny.
Oh, I do? That's unfortunate.
It's when, evolution it's when wise. when you start to say things, like when you start to draw it out, you do it exactly the way he does. It's kind of funny.
Anyways. Maybe an unnecessary or unfortunate consequence of being classically trained in music.
You sound exactly like him. It's so funny. Anyways, go on.
Evolution-wise, okay, what's the main arguments for evolution, in your opinion?
Every single thing in the fossil record is a species that doesn't exist today, and all life on the planet shares genes. Those are two necessary components of evolution. And they didn't have to be the case. We didn't come up with evolution after we realized those two facts. There were a lot of fossils that were known, like in the Victorian era, but nowhere close to what we have today. And so the hypothesis was formed, the fossil record was instrumental in the formation of the hypothesis, but further fossil discoveries have only confirmed it pretty dramatically. And the thing about all life being related, that was a specific prediction, and that had to be the case. It's necessarily the case. If no life on the planet was related, then evolution would have just been killed right then and there when we figured that out. But instead, it was exactly what evolution thought it would be like.
Okay, so all life on Earth is related. That is a current evolutionary thought framework?
Yeah, there's no life form on the planet that doesn't use DNA. We have the same hereditary molecule. And so when things reproduce, they pass on DNA. And so the offspring all have to have that DNA. But it would also be predictably different between different groups. The other thing... So it's actually worse than that, and by worse than that, I mean better than that for evolution, because maybe all life on the planet does have DNA, but evolution's false. Pretty hard to imagine how that would be true, but there's a test for that. If we shared more genes with, I don't know, ants than we do with chimpanzees, that would also effectively have disproven evolution, because that's the exact opposite of what you would expect.
All right. Logically speaking, though, a creator, if I was building a piece of code on a computer, for instance, all right, wouldn't I use consistent forms of code, even if I'm building different, you know, action sequences, things that I'm trying to do differently, even though I think I communicated badly, but still effectively there?
You can imagine that, but there's no reason to think that. That's the case, because I can ask you this question. If it turned out that no life on the planet shared any DNA, would that prove God doesn't exist?
No life on the planet shares any DNA. Well, you can't prove a negative.
Well, you can, yeah. Would it be evidence that God doesn't exist?
No.
Right. So if the DNA looks the way it does because God did it, is one possibility. But also, if DNA looked the opposite way it does because God did it, is also valid, then it's not actually evidence.
I'm just saying, if humans came from monkeys, why are there still monkeys? You can't have an atmosphere next to a vacuum. The Big Bang violates the second law of thermodynamics. Everything that's created requires a creator. Show me curvature. There are no missing links. Evolution has never been observed. The Earth is only 6,000 years old.
Okay, but here's the thing. Evolution and creation are presented as opposites in this debate, right?
They don't have to be. If I know people that think that God exists, but that God created the Earth billions of years ago and created the first living things on our planet, and then evolution has just done its thing since then. Yeah, you can believe that. If God's all powerful, he can do that too. I don't think there's a good reason to think that that's what happened. But they don't have to be. I do think that young Earth creationism and evolution and the Big Bang, yes, are, I guess you can say, opposites.
Framed as such in most debates, at least.
Yes.
Yeah. I just don't see. Okay, actually, observation. Bring it back to science, right? Observation is the root of all scientific knowledge, correct? Yeah.
If in the sense that that's where it begins, yeah, I guess that makes sense.
Yeah, I'm just saying that that's where it starts. You look at something, right. You make a hypothesis, you're consistent. Okay. I don't know of any point where new DNA has entered a genome of a species that's been productive. There's been cancers, of course, but that's always destructive. I don't know of productive, positive new DNA in our observation.
Well, I do. I mean, there's examples such as mammals like us. We have a placenta that came from a virus. Viruses can inject DNA that gets incorporated into your genome. That's what retroviruses are. Now, young Earth creationist is going to argue, oh, but you're claiming that happened billions of years ago. So you're just, or not billions of years ago, but millions of years ago. I want something that I can actually see and test and whatever, whatever. Well, we know of many examples of new genes that organisms have acquired that don't have a genetic precursor. So, for example, nylon digesting bacteria. There are some bacteria that can now digest nylon. That's obviously new. They weren't doing it before nylon existed. And they weren't doing it directly after nylon existed either. It wasn't a thing where they had the gene for it. There just never was any nylon, and then they started doing it. No, it took many decades before that actually started being the case. But there are also these are called de novo mutations or genes. There are.
Can I interject?
Yeah, go ahead.
All right. So. To me, that sounds like adaptation, not evolution.
Adaptation is just downstream of evolution.
All right. So you've probably heard that, you know, a lot of young creationists go microevolution versus macroevolution. Microevolution being referred to more in an adaptation sense. Macroevolution is kind of what I referenced earlier, where it's adding to the genome, adding to things that are constructive, right? So I have no issue with microevolution in that sense, where it's adaptation to something new, a stimuli, an environment, whatever it be.
But that's what evolution is. Evolution is change over time. The only way organisms can change over time is through changes in their genes or gene expression.
No, exactly. Gene expression. So the presumption with microevolution being reality and macroevolution not being is that there is a unactivated gene that is then either pronounced or then activated by external stimuli.
No, sometimes de novo genes are genes that literally didn't exist before, but then a mutation in the genome occurs that creates a brand new gene. And we know of examples of those. There are Arctic fish that produce a protein that acts as an antifreeze, and it comes from a part of their DNA that used to not be genes. It was non-coding DNA. There's another kind of fish that they also produce an antifreeze protein, and they got it from a pre-existing gene, but a gene that makes a pancreatic enzyme. So a pancreatic enzyme gene mutated and now produces an antifreeze protein. It's a gene mutating into another gene, but it's a completely different function. And then we know of some examples in fruit flies too.
I have never heard of any of those examples before, I'll be honest.
A year ago, neither had I, and I was a science teacher for a decade. Because these are like extremely niche and high resolution things. In order to establish good evidence that evolution is true, you don't go to the minutia. You go to the general, which is the genes, the fossil record, comparative anatomy, embryology, and a few other things.
Okay. But that goes back to the argument that I made before, which is if you can't demonstrate evolution in action beyond simple adaptation to an organism's environment or stimuli, I don't see there's any evidence for it other than incorrect extrapolation.
But that's exactly what would record. But that's what would have to occur in order for evolution to be true.
What?
The small scale changes. What do you when an organism micro evolves? Organisms don't micro evolve, populations do. So you have a generation of organisms. The next generation, their DNA is all going to be a little bit different. That just always happens. We know that. And so they may end up having adaptations that the prior generation did not have. Does that make sense so far?
Yes. Yeah. I'm tracking.
Okay. Well, those adaptations don't go away. And then that first generation, they're going to produce a new generation. They're going to have the new adaptations that their parents had that their grandparents didn't have, but then they're going to have their own as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that never stops. So when there have been hundreds of thousands or millions or whatever it is of generations, think of how many cumulative adaptations there are, and then ask yourself, why would I expect the thing hundreds of thousands of generations later would be identical to the thing we began with? There's absolutely no logical reason to think that's the case. Now, yeah, you can say
logically under a young Earth philosophy. I'm just going to let's keep it confined to this part specifically. Under a young Earth philosophy with the fall. OK, that's where genetic degradation started to happen, according to most young Earth people that believe in young Earth. Right. So you're going to have degradation and small
there
minute
isn't
changes.
Degradation. If degradation were happening, all populations would be collapsing. It's just so obviously not the case, like at all. And natural selection can select for weak negative mutations. This has been known for a while. But we'll stick with not the fall, but I was going to go to the flood, right? So there are, we've so far discovered, like we've been able to name so far, like 1.5 million species. There's almost certainly way more than that, like 10 times more than that. We just haven't found them yet, right? You're with me so far.
Okay, yeah, there's a lot of species. I'm with you.
Let's just go with 1.5 million for now. There weren't 1.5 million species on the Ark. There just weren't, right?
Yep.
Okay, so how the hell can a few thousand species turn into 1.5 million different species in a span of like it would have literally happened in the span of only a couple years or a couple centuries. How can that happen? That is a kind of hyperdrive macroevolution like nobody has ever seen. that's vastly more dramatic of an evolution than we're imagining, because you're imagining it has to occur. You have to go from thousands to millions in literally years. Well, we're saying over the course of billions of years, all the species we see today emerged.
How many of those 1.5 species are land-dwelling, first off?
Most of them.
Most of them. Okay. Yeah. So what, a couple hundred thousand are sea-dwelling?
Probably not even a couple hundred thousand. My memory is telling me there are around 30,000 species of fish. The vast majority of them are insects.
Okay. Well, insects survive floods all the time. Just like floods don't automatically kill insects. Right?
How long were the waters up? 40 days? Or do you think it was closer to a year? I can't ever
I believe it started receding after around, I want to say 90 to 100. I mean, don't quote me on that, but it
took,
was up there.
It took 40 days for the waters to get to their maximum level, and then the waters were at their maximum level for, you think, 100 days?
I want to say that. I could be wrong, but it seems like a good number to me.
Okay. So, where the hell are we, where am I going with this? So the insect, I mean, they're not going to be able to eat anything for 100 days. I mean, I don't know, 150 days.
Very common for insects.
Say that again.
They would eat themselves. Cannibal in this hypothetical, cannibalism is not shied away from any.
There's no land for them to even exist on.
In a cataclysmic flood like that, there's not going to be stuff floating on the top.
Right. I mean, yeah, I guess there would be rafts and stuff like that. Okay, so like you can get away with the insects, but like frogs, for example, right? Frogs. Frogs can't swim in salt water for 150 days. They just can't. Okay. That's not the case.
How many species of frogs are there?
There's thousands of species of frogs. There are 50 families of frogs. Yeah. So however many frogs were on that ark would have had to have turned into thousands of different species of frogs in the blink of an eye, in a matter of only years. How can the transformation from whatever the stock type of frog is to all the thousands of types of frogs that there are is way in only a period of years is way more dramatic than the idea that life has evolved gradually over billions of years. It's way more dramatic.
I disagree, because look at how we've changed what the expression of dogs and their traits in, 200 years? And we've just butchered so many different, or created so many different new, quote-unquote, species of dogs, right?
Yeah, but that's intentional. I mean, the changes are rapid because they're intentional. And in nature, even if God exists, in nature, it wouldn't be like that. The frogs are just going to hippity hop to their own bite. This is the other thing. How the fuck did South American frogs get to South America after the flood? Like, how? They can't swim in salt water. How the hell are they going to get from Mount Ararat to South America? But we'll just like forget that for now. But
yeah, that's a whole, that's like a more conversation.
Yeah. But the changes we see in dogs are really dramatic. The changes in nature, they happen more slowly than that, even if God exists. Because even if God exists, the frogs have to hippity hop off the ark and then migrate into different biomes around the world. So that stock frog has to turn into all these other frogs, like in comparatively no time at all. And if only a couple, and like I can even grant you that there were 100 species of frogs on the ark and they turned into the however many thousands of species of frogs there are today. I can grant you that. There is absolutely no reason why then we shouldn't see species of frogs just pop into existence today. You'd have to believe evolution went into hyperdrive right after the flood and then for no reason at all stagnated. Because we don't see
why, in this hypothetical, the reason why I would go into hyperdrive is new environments for these, you know, say there's 50 stock, 50, you know, originals that were on the ark, right? All right. And then they introduce them into new environments. They adapt to those environments with pre-existing expressions of pre-existing you know, DNA, all right, for instance. And then once you stop introducing new environments, you're going to stop seeing rapid adaptation, right? Logically?
So this kind of radiative speciation is actually a pretty good point. Once they populate the world, there aren't any frogs in the rainforest, so then they have to become all the different frogs that live in the rainforest. But then the rainforest is full of frogs, and the environment is just the environment, so no new speciation. That's a fair point. However, you do know that droves of species are going extinct today, right?
Yes. Yeah.
And that's mostly because of what we do to the environment, right?
That's arguable, but I'll give it to you. Yeah.
Well, I mean, we destroy habitats for agriculture and things like that. We're acidifying the ocean with our emissions and all kinds of things. If what you're saying about new niches leads to radiative speciation, so we would expect this to happen, I would not expect species to be going extinct at the rate they are today. If they can kick it into hyperdrive post-flood, then they can kick it into hyperdrive to adapt to the conditions that we are artificially creating on this planet.
Well, wouldn't the adaptation be in the form of killing off anybody that can't, or any version of the species that can't survive in that environment? Right? So
death is not adaptation.
Okay. I think I spoke very poorly there. With frogs, okay, let's keep on the frogs in the Amazon. We destroy the Amazon. We're cutting it down, like, for farmland, right?
Regardless of evolution versus young Earth creationism, microevolution, regardless, in both cases, those that are not the most adapted do die.
Exactly.
But there are always some that survive.
But we're not seeing,
and the some that survive, they make the population either go up or remain steady. But we're not seeing go up or remain steady. We're seeing massive death and extinction.
Because we're in the death arc of the population, okay? So in this example, the current the environment is being changed by us rapidly over the course of, you know, what, a couple generations for these species. So these generations are dying off because their environment's being taken away by us. So even under young Earth, where it takes generations for them to adapt to a new environment, they would still die off in the manner that they're dying off. But you would see in the next, you know, 100 years, form of that is that is adapted to a new environment. Now the issue comes in that we're changing the environment so quickly. We clear cut a forest, it's clear cut now. We farm it for what, 20 years, and then it's dead, and then we just leave it, right?
I don't think that that's...
So it doesn't have time to adapt.
I don't think that that's nearly as fast as the rate at which species were introduced to new environments post-flood. That was so much more rapid.
How would it be rapid? More rapid than that?
Because the species would be radiating from wherever they're coming from and being introduced to brand new environments. Being introduced to a brand new environment... It doesn't matter if the environment was already there and you're being introduced to it, or if you were already in the environment and we're changing it. It's both. In both cases, it's a population being introduced to a brand new environment. But in one case, they're somehow able to speciate and be wildly successful in that environment just basically right away. And today they can't keep up. But I would argue that the changes today are slower than they were. It's taken us, like, we're not even close to deforesting the planet yet. There's still all kinds of trees on this planet. And yet the comparatively little we've been able to do, there are species that have completely gone extinct or can't. Look, a better example, actually, rather than environmental... like destruction, like us literally taking the environment away. A much better example would be environmental modification via invasive species, right? There's no, like, post-flood, every single species was an invasive species. Species would have been coming and going into environments at crazy different intervals. Today, just a single invasive, like we know of huge numbers of examples, but a single invasive species makes other species die and or go extinct incredibly quickly. I wouldn't expect that if somehow species are able to radiatively speciate, I don't know if that's really a term, like what would have to happen post-flood, there's no reason that species wouldn't be able to adapt to invasive species today. There just isn't any good reason.
Okay. There are theories of post-flood massive such as oxygen levels of oxygen in the atmosphere. Have you ever heard that theory?
You cut off a bunch, but you said there are young Earth creationist theories about rapid environmental changes such as rapid oxygenation of the atmosphere?
Deoxygenate. Oh, if I could speak, that would help.
Yeah, I mean, there's, I don't know what on earth they propose could have possibly been the cause of the oxygen levels going down.
Well, all right, actually, I can answer that one. It is due to pre-flood, and you're going to hate this because this involves some miracles and other physics. But the idea is that pre-flood, there was a massive sheet of water in the above the atmosphere that was pressurizing the entire ecology. The firmament. And then after the flood, when that went away, the pressurization went down. Therefore, the oxygen in the atmosphere went down. That is the theory as far as I'm concerned.
That's a terrible theory because 50% of the atmosphere is located within, I think, like 10 miles or something like that. Let me look this up real quick. How many miles up do you have to go to find 50% of the mass of the air? I don't know how to ask this. What I'm trying to communicate is the atmosphere goes up like 100 miles, but the density of the atmosphere is so thick down below that half of the atmosphere is located in like the first like 5% or something like that. I'm trying to figure it out right now.
I believe it's an exponential increase.
So 50% of Earth's atmosphere lies below an altitude of 3.4 miles. So literally, if that firmament was only 6 miles above the sea, or above sea level, what, you would only increase the concentration by, would that even increase it? That wouldn't even increase the concentration. I mean, even if you pack the atmosphere down, that's not going to make it more concentrated at the bottom. Maybe it would. No, because the gravitation, the gradient with the field of gravity, it is so negligible in a span of only 6 miles that it would actually just evenly distribute. It wouldn't dramatically concentrate it near the surface. Let me, you think about whatever you want to say, and then I'm going to see if that can.
I'm not even fully convinced of that theory. I've just heard it as a theory. And, you know, I'm kind of enjoying you watching or listening to you rip it apart as well. So. I guess the whole point of that statement was the environment could be drastically different, be pre-flood versus post-flood, assuming that there was a flood and the Bible is true, okay? Meaning adaptation has different rates at that point.
Right. What? Oh, well, more oxygen is not going to get you faster speciation. I don't know why. That wouldn't do anything like that. It would make biology on the planet different, but it wouldn't make speciation happen more quickly. You could argue it'd actually be detrimental because more oxygen means more free radicals.
Okay, no, that's fair. That's fair. Another theory I've heard in regard to that is the level of radiation that would be hitting the planet due to solar rays. If there was a firmament, wouldn't that cut that amount of radiation down? Due to the fact it has to pass through something that's, you know, semi-permeable?
I'm fact-checking myself right now. I'm almost about that claim I made about the density of the atmosphere, so give me just a second.
You're good.
Increased by about 1.3. Okay, so this is, and this is just ChatGPT, which is usually pretty good at these kind of things. It's saying the atmosphere would get about a third more dense, even at sea level. That's actually kind of surprising to me, but yeah, it's not as dramatic as you would maybe think. So anyways.
Actually, that's kind of what I had in mind when I was saying higher density, because isn't it around 40% that the atmosphere becomes like ignitable without like as far as 40% oxygen?
Yeah, that's what we think. Well, no, not 40% more. It was when the atmosphere, we think during the Carboniferous, the atmosphere was about 40% oxygen. So that's actually a 100% increase in oxygen, because we're at about 20 now. So,
I know that at some point with the oxygen density, the atmosphere would become like ignitable as far as fire.
Yeah. What were you asking before, while I was looking at that? I don't remember.
Okay. Presupposing the firmament. Okay. Wouldn't that cut down on radiation exposure to the surface?
Oh, UV radiation.
So I'm saying that if
it was water. I mean, if it was water,
that could definitely change a lot of rules.
If there was enough water to block UV radiation, there would be enough water to block sunlight, meaning plants wouldn't grow.
All right, cool.
I don't know the answer to this. Yeah, that actually makes perfect sense.
What does? I lost track of you. Sorry.
I shouldn't do this, but per your argument, visible light penetrates water way farther than UV radiation does. I'm trying to get what the actual number is. Oh, geez. Okay, well, that actually...
Wait, visible light...
Well, it...
Does
it
penetrate water...
It depends. I'll show you the graph here. So, it's going to take it a minute to refresh. It's on a different page for some reason. But, so UV... Oh, that's violet. I thought that was the... So, UVA and UVB get stopped pretty quickly. Blue goes really far, green goes pretty far. So UV, but red and orange and yellow, well, at least for red and orange, they don't go as far as UVB does. So I don't know. Plants get, chlorophyll gets most of its absorption out of actually two different wavelengths, blue and red. So if you had a firmament, you'd literally be cutting off half of the main light for plants. Could it block UV radiation? Yeah, but it would still be absolutely devastating for plants.
Can we look up how much plants depend on red? I'm just curious at this point. You don't have to, but.
It's like not quite as much as blue, but it's a really big spike. What the hell do I type for this? Chlorophyll absorption spectrum. Yeah, that's what you type. It looks like it's going to take a second again, but it looks like you'll see it pretty soon. It looks like this.
Okay, yeah, about half and half then. All right, cool. Yeah.
Pert near, as we say in the Midwest.
All right, cool. Well, I appreciate the conversation. I know we're never going to agree, but honestly, I'm glad we were able to keep it civil. So I got to get back to work, so I got to go.
All right. Have fun.
You have a good day. Bye.
Get a free book, 2 free audiobooks, and ad-free videos by becoming a Patreon member.